Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. His name is Dave Knapp, and he is the host of the On the Pen podcast, which you will hear all about. He's also an author of this book, Decoding GLP-1, but his main emphasis is going to be on his podcast and the information that he shares. So welcome, Dave. Hello.
Thank you, Hillary. Thanks for having me today.
So how many podcast episodes have you done?
My own podcasts, hundreds at this point, hundreds. Yeah. For 2 years, we did a live show every single night on Thursday, which got uploaded to the podcast. We just ended that for the summer, might pick it back up in the fall, but that was a big commitment. And then we do a weekly one. We've been doing it for about a year and a half, a news roundup. And so, yeah, I mean, hundreds at this point.
Wow.
Lots of StreamYard.
Yeah. And when did you start doing this?
So I started making content on YouTube in regards to like this topic in the fall of 2022. And so it evolved quickly into something that I didn't maybe started out intending it to be, but we've been making content for that long.
Okay. So I did read the book. But I want you to tell, what were you doing before all this happened?
Selling traffic signals, right? Naturally. Yeah, I spent the last 10 years
like
of my
life. Traffic lights?
Yeah, like stoplights.
Wow.
Red, yellow, green. So I worked for a company that manufactured portable traffic signals, so like solar-powered solar traffic lights for construction zones. And I did that marketing and sales for about 10 years.
Wow. So, okay. So your story was, I guess you had a propensity to gain weight. That's how you were doing just the, cheeseburgers for a while or something.
So you pretty much got it right. From a pretty young age, I mean, like high school, young is all relative term.
Yeah.
But as a young adult, I really struggled with my weight. You know, going back to my early childhood, I had a little tummy, right? But just enough to really notice that I was different than my peers. And my buddies would have their shirts off. They'd have like abs and you could see their ribs. And I just had a little bit of chunk on me. And so I recognized in myself that I was a little bit different. I honestly, in my immediate family, with my siblings, I have three siblings. I had two parents. None of them were overweight. I was the only one, but on either side of my family, you didn't have to go very far on either side of my family, aunts, uncles, cousins, all pretty much struggled with weight. And so, especially on my mom's side of the family, if you, it's interesting kind of how genetics work, but if you put me next to my siblings, they're all dark hair, brown eyes. I'm the only kid with blue eyes and had blonde hair. And I looked just like the cousins on my mom's side. That side of the family has weight struggles, obesity struggles, diabetes struggles. And so I really think that I just expressed those genetics a little bit stronger than my siblings did. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that it's, you know, this is all 100% genetics, but it's definitely obesity is multifactorial. Genetics are one of them. I noticed something different. So late high school. Yeah, go ahead.
Would you say that you ate differently?
No. I mean, we were eating the same things.
So the same things, different.
Yeah. Of course, excuse me. as we got a little bit older and I got a little bit more autonomy with, you know, being able to drive, my first job was in at an Arby's. So curly, steady diet of curly fries and roast beef didn't help. But honestly, before I had started there, I was packing on weight. And since I was really young, I had a job. I always had a job. I had a paper route. I was active. I played all the sports growing up. It's just that I, you know, carried a little bit more weight, shorter frame too, probably than most of my peers. But when I started working at Arby's, I had already like been carrying enough weight to where I was watching what I was eating with dieting. And that was really about the first time that I was introduced to the Atkins diet. So when I worked at Arby's, I just ate a lot of roast beef and actually cut a lot of weight while I was there. But I did, you know, that's kind of the long and short of my story is I discovered the Atkins diet early on and then chasing some early success throughout my early adulthood into up until just a few years ago. Every year I would sort of chase that initial success I had of about a 50, 60 pound weight loss. And I would be able to lose 20 or 25 before I just crash and burn on that kind of restriction. That it's just ketogenic diet, you know, works for a lot of people, but for most people that try it and most people that try dieting in general, extreme restriction will find themselves crashing and burning and gaining more weight on the upside. And that was the cycle of my life from about 17 years old to about 36, 37.
So do you think, I remember doing we did a study in college on fad diets. And I'll tell you, it messed me up. You know, we tried them and, you know, you'd be restricted at the end, you'd gain it back plus, and then that you just kept going. Do you know what I mean? And it just, and I remember our thesis or whatever, I don't know how big of a paper we wrote, but it was like, they don't work. They don't work. One of my friends, she ate like one of those chicken dinner, like for a family of five. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I guess it was allowed on the Atkins or whatever, but then she went off it. So it's, you know, I'm like, oh my God, not only did you just, you know, like, so it really messed us up. I mean,
well, I think especially the low carb diet has something about it that can uniquely screw you up, because with the Atkins diet or a ketogenic diet in general, I mean, for the longest time, sort of the prevailing wisdom was, well, you don't have to watch your calories. It doesn't matter. You won't eat enough calories for it to matter because you'd be so full from the protein and the fat that you won't need to watch your calories. And honestly, what I think it did for me, and I was just on a different podcast yesterday talking about this, and the guy had kind of the same theory or had come up with a theory. And I was like, I think that's me, but that you are on it so often that you forget that, you know, caloric restriction is actually at the end of the day, you know, that's energy. So if you could restrict energy intake, you're probably going to lose weight. It's just finding what that energy threshold is. And that's different for everybody.
So, okay. So if we track your weight gain, it was the going down and then going up a little higher. And then each time it got a little higher.
Yeah. It was kind of this roller coaster of losing 25 pounds and gaining 30 or 35, you know, basically for almost 20 years of my life. And just to kind of go back to what you were saying about that kind of anecdotal study that you guys did in college, you know, there are other studies that have been done on a larger scale that show that diets don't work. Right. They don't work. Oftentimes, especially in cases of extreme restriction, like one of the most interesting studies that they did was they looked at the contestants on The Biggest Loser. Like, we've actually had one of the contestants from The Biggest Loser on our podcast. And what they did was they took a group of the folks from The Biggest Loser and they tracked them for a number of years after The Biggest Loser. And what they found was the extreme restriction and extreme exercise that went along with that basically ruined their metabolism. Most everybody gained their weight back and more in that study. And so it's just kind of like a little microcosm, I think, of what's happened on a larger scale. But yeah, I mean, for me, it was a roller coaster every year for about 20 years of losing 25, gaining 30. And so by the time I was, I went into the doctor's office of complaining of like extreme fatigue. I call it narcolepsy level tiredness. I just knew, like I told my wife, I was like, there's something incredibly wrong with me. I have cancer or I don't know what it is, but I'm extremely not well. So I went into the doctor.
How old were you?
36 years old. I thought for about 6 or 8 months, I thought I had long COVID. I was just like, you know, I had COVID really bad a couple times in the preceding year. And the second time I just never really recovered. And when I went into the doctor's office, I was at 319 pounds at that point on a 5'10" frame. So extremely morbidly obese. And he ran my A1C, which is, for those of you who may not know what that is, it's basically a 3-month rolling average of your blood sugars. It's how they determine whether you're diabetic or not. If you're above about 5.6, they say, you know, that's getting into the pre-diabetes diabetic range. And mine was an 8. So pretty high, obviously, what they call frank diabetes. So type 2 frank. Yep. Like the name Frank. So it's not pre-diabetes. It's, you know, frankly, it's diabetes. Oh. I don't know. That's the way I think of it.
Yeah. supposed to be? What's the number supposed to be?
I believe it's 5.6 or below.
Okay.
And mine was an 8 or 7.9, I think. But, wow. You know, the thing about it is for most people, especially as you get older, you're going in for your routine physical every year. They're checking your A1C. It's a normal thing they check on a normal lab when you get your yearly done. And most people will see it creep up over a period of 10 years. You know, it's a 5.5, next year's 5.6, 5.7. You start to creep up and your doctor says, hey, you're in the pre-diabetic range. You know, you might want to do something about your weight. You might want to do something about your diet. For me, I went from 0 to 100. I mean, I was never pre-diabetic, and I just, you know, it's a sidebar, but my theory is I think COVID actually put some people who are metabolically at risk into metabolic dysfunction. And so I believe for some people, and there are some early studies that kind of show that that may be the case, but whether that was me or whether it wasn't, the end result is the same. I had diabetes and the doctor goes, Dave, what do you want to do? And I'm looking at it like my dad died at 54 from a massive heart attack and he wasn't even overweight. He's a chain smoker. He was a chain smoker, but he's a smoker. I'm not, but he wasn't even overweight. And so I'm looking at 4 kids and I'm like, how do I stay healthy? And he goes, what do you want to do?
Kids?
Yeah. Four little kids, ages 5 all the way up to 11. And so, little kids, you know, and I'm like, I want to be around to see all the things. I want to see them graduate high school and get married. I want to coach their teams. I want to do all those things. And I don't want to be on medicine. And so my doctor says, well, you need to do the keto diet. And I was like, well, I'm willing to buckle down and do it, but I just want you to know it has not treated me well for the last 20 years. And so I left that day with a prescription for the keto diet and I buckled down for a year, a solid year. And it got my A1C from that 8 number down to 5.4. So non-diabetic, mm-hmm. But my weight in 1 year, Hillary, went from 319 to 312. I lost 7 pounds in a year. And I probably lost that first 7 pounds in the first month. You know, I just could not lose weight. My insulin levels were still off the chart. And then at that point, he was like, well, you're either a candidate for surgery or medicine, and sort of the rest is history.
Mm. So you were 36.
36. Yeah. Yeah. And then.
So tell the, if you don't mind telling them what happened. You
did. Yeah.
You weren't a candidate for the surgery, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So I count myself, I mean, I was scared to death of having my insides rerouted at such a young age. Like for some people, that's their only hope. For me, I felt like there has to be a better answer at this age, but I was willing to do anything my doctor said. Because at that point, I want to be alive for my kids. If you think it's going to be something that's going to make me live longer for my kids, I'll listen. I'll do what you need me to do. And so I looked into the insurance, and thankfully, I didn't have coverage for bariatric surgery. But since I was diabetic, he said, you're going to qualify to get these expensive new medications. But what these medications are, and this is his words, he said, they're accomplishing hormonally what gets accomplished through bariatric surgery. In other words, most people think that bariatric surgery works because you just stop eating because you have a smaller stomach or because you're not absorbing as much because they reroute how everything works. They reroute your plumbing. He said, but actually what happens is there's a restoration of these hormones, and they're learning more about these hormones, but they're called nutrient stimulated hormones. They're hormones your gut releases in response to eating food. And they're all sorts of screwed up, and especially type 2 diabetics, right? To not get too into the science, but they have studies that show that the gut bacteria in people who are diabetic is way out of whack. And there's a certain gut bacteria that's orders of magnitude higher than it is in people who are not diabetic. And its byproduct is called DPP-4. And DPP-4 ruins nutrient-stimulated hormones. It's like number one job is to just destroy nutrient-stimulated hormones. And those are the hormones that signal to your brain that you're full. So you start to see how this becomes a biological issue at a certain point. And DPP-4, so DPP-4 medications have been around since way before the medicines we're talking about today. DPP-4 inhibitors is what they were called. And they basically were designed to kind of destroy that DPP-4 so that your nutrient-stimulated hormones could live long enough to signal to the brain, hey, this person is full. Hey, release. You know, they do a number of things, and we can get into that if you want to. But that's sort of the genesis of how they began to explore this idea of GLP-1 receptor agonist medications.
So is that the reason? Well, I see a couple things. There's a woman I know, and she said, you know, she has food noise. Yeah. And you said in the book, you know, you're eating lunch, you're already thinking about what you're going to have for dinner. Like, there's this food noise.
Yeah, you never get satiated.
Because of this hormonal thing?
That's the idea. I guess I would never go far enough to share I'll just share what my personal experience is, and then I'll share some of the science that's coming out around this whole idea of food noise. So you teed it up perfectly well. I mean, this concept of food noise is this idea that you have thoughts of food that are sort of inescapable. They can't be put on mute. It's just, what am I going to eat? What am I going to eat next? Am I going to have enough? If you go somewhere out to eat with friends, you're going to eat there. Is there going to be enough? Am I going to eat too much? You know, all these things sort of rattle around, and it's a sort of an all-consuming thought. Your mind doesn't focus on any other thing, right? And I experienced that not incessantly, but definitely quite a bit throughout my life, right? And so
why do some people have it and some don't?
It's a good question. I think everybody experiences cravings to some extent where, hey, I want to try this. I want to try that. And I think it all has to do with genetic predisposition, perhaps. But I think also some of it's, there's it's multifactorial, right? There could be, behavior is just going to reinforce behavior. It could be genetics. It could be all sorts of things. But when it comes to the concept of food noise, again, I'm sharing my experience and maybe, the experience of others in the OTP community. But there was a study that was done, just data that was just published this last month. And this is really interesting. So what they did was they took a group of people and they actually started doing brain scans of these people before they put them on these medications. And when I talk about these medications, I guess we haven't really got to the point. Yeah. These medications we're talking about are GLP-1 receptor agonists, like Ozempic. That's the one that seems to resonate with everybody. They've heard of Ozempic, and they just know people lose a lot of weight when they take it, right? GLP-1s are one of these nutrient-stimulated hormones that we talked about, and perhaps the most prominent, and also the ones that are most susceptible to being destroyed by that DPP-4 that we talked about. So when you talk about metabolic dysfunction, obesity, diabetes, oftentimes people are dysregulated in that hormone. They're either their bodies are not getting it to last long enough to signal to the brain that they're full, et cetera. And so what they found is, it's interesting how they kind of discovered GLP-1 receptor agonists, but they found a way to make peptides and put them in like this fatty molecule that makes it so that DPP-4 can't destroy them. And so it just makes it last longer in your body. So it binds to the receptors in your body the same way that the natural stuff that you make does, but it can't be killed by that gut bacteria byproduct DPP-4.
Okay. So DPP-4 is the thing that ruins the hormones. Where does that come from again?
It's a byproduct of gut bacteria. So that gut, and this again, studies have been done to show that in people with type 2 diabetes, especially, those gut bacteria that produce DPP-4 are orders of magnitude higher in the guts of people who are diabetic than people who are not. So in other words, you have an exorbitantly high amount of DPP-4 that's destroying the scientific word is endogenous, but it's just a fancy way of saying the kind your body makes. And that DPP-4 destroys it. So you're not getting the same kind of signaling between your gut and your brain. There's this gut-brain access.
To say stop eating.
But even, it's responsible for other things. Besides just satiation, it's responsible for, signaling the beta cells in your pancreas to release insulin efficiently. It's designed to act in your brain to actually slow how quickly your stomach and digestive system processes food. So it slows digestion, signals fullness, signals the beta cells in the pancreas to make insulin. All these things are affecting, you know, multiple metabolic processes beyond just making you eat less. But that's certainly the biggest part that helps to lead to weight loss ultimately. But we're talking about DPP-4 and how these are these GLP-1 receptor agonists have been designed to not be ruined by the DPP-4, right? And so they found a way to just basically make a peptide that mimics the hormone that your body makes, but it can't be destroyed by the DPP-4. And then it binds to the receptors. So you're getting that signaling sort of restored between your gut and your brain to signal fullness and satiation. And so in the study that we're talking about, they start people who are obese by looking at pictures of highly palatable foods, right? So they're looking at cheeseburgers and they're looking at, you know, pies and cakes and ice cream and all that stuff. And they're watching on brain scans, these areas of the brain light up. Okay. So they can physically see them light up. And then they're introduced to tirzepatide and an older version called liraglutide. The folks on tirzepatide, which is the newest iteration of these drugs, it's called Mounjaro and Zepbound are the marketing names for them on the market. Mounjaro is what I take. I'm, you know, my handle is Man on the Mounjaro. That's for diabetes. The Zepbound is the same exact thing, just the FDA indication is for obesity, right? But it's all tirzepatide. The folks that were given tirzepatide, this newer drug, they watched those areas on the brain as they were given the drug just stop lighting up, right? So when the brain once responded in a certain way to highly palatable foods or being presented with highly palatable foods, it is as if the tirzepatide just sort of shut down those parts of the brain that were inclined to be excitable towards them. And so this was one of the newer studies that just came out that maybe shows a little bit of like that food noise happening in the brain, that that excitability, that consuming thoughts, all those things. And these medications, you know, they work in the brain to sort of quiet that all down.
So when they're shown that and their brain lights up, they want to eat it, right?
Yeah, essentially, it's
get excited or something.
There's an excitability factor, involved in being presented with that.
And when they have the drug and they don't have it, it's like, oh, cheeseburger, who cares, right? Like,
yeah, it's sort of an indifference. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, Hillary, is they're already doing studies because scientists and researchers can already see the potential value in treating a broader addiction with this. So imagine you replace the images of food with images of gambling or smoking or drinking. They're already showing that these medications are a viable treatment in alcohol dependency. Many people who get on these medications will say, you know, I went from 2 glasses of wine a night to I haven't had a glass of wine in 6 months. I just don't think of it. And when I have one, I don't care for it. There's studies that are showing that these medications can actually change your taste buds. In other words, your body sort of adapts and sort of becomes repulsed by things you once loved. People who once enjoyed a cup of coffee in the morning don't really care about their coffee anymore. It's pretty wild, the implications of this. And of course that does, to be fair, raise a lot of questions about the long-term use of these. If something that was once giving you some sort of pleasure or reward or, you know, excitement, and all of a sudden you remove that, you know, how does that affect somebody mentally long-term? And so I think these are all things that need to be looked at. Some people will say, well, that's the danger of using medications that are brand new. And that is something that I like to remind people that at least the GLP-1s are not brand new. The first GLP-1 to hit the market is now 20 years old. So these, you know, time flies, right? But But Byetta, you can look it up. Byetta, the active ingredient is exenatide. That was, and you notice they all end with tide because they're peptides. Exenatide has a unique story if you want to hear it. The first one to hit the market, there was this doctor. His name was Dr. Eng, E-N-G, and he was looking at different lizard venoms and what peptides existed in lizard venom. And one of the properties that existed in a venom of the Gila monster actually was like a pretty close match to our endogenous GLP-1 hormone. And so this peptide that they extracted from the Gila monster venom was called exenatide or exendin-4. And then they reproduced that in a lab, that peptide, and that was exenatide. And that's actually the first GLP-1 medication was built upon the structure of a venomous lizard.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Okay, I have a question. I don't know how it fits in, but you know, if people are, you know, having their alcohol or having this or having that, and it's having them not want it, like to me, you could say wrong topic, but like when I was numbing myself, that's mm-hmm. you know, my book subtitle about numbing. I was not feeling my feelings. And so I was, you know, by Friday night, nothing had changed. Give me the nachos and margaritas or the pizza and beer, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. That was my numbing technique. If they were numbing and now they have that drug and now, does it mean they're not numbing or they don't have the emotion or what?
It's a really great question. And I don't have a scientific answer for that, but I'll just share anecdotally from the community. One of the largest topics of conversation within the GLP-1 community is this topic of transfer addiction. Mm. And the idea is that you had one thing that, you know, was sort of your vice or your outlet or your addiction, and it goes away, it's going to go somewhere. And there's a lot of people who actually live in this community who go, yeah, mine went from food to content creation. Now I just make a bunch of TikToks and that's what I do. And I'm obsessed about it and it occupies my mind and it's my release. For other people, it can be more serious. Other people do, you know, fall into other traps. Of course, they're not out on TikTok talking about what those traps are, but you can imagine what they may be. It may be an uptick in the amount of alcohol that is consumed, you know, is all of a sudden you're not getting it from food. And even though you may physically feel like you don't want the alcohol, eventually, if you just slam it down, you're going to feel the effects of being drunk, just like you would without a medication. And perhaps that becomes a vice for people. Gambling, I mean, a sex addiction, all of these things can be, you know, transfer addictions. I mean, I think it's something that I'm certainly not credentialed to talk about, but when you talk about mental health and addiction behaviors and stuff like that, it's definitely a topic that's widely discussed in those arenas. And I think it probably bleeds over into this as well.
Mm. Yeah. I had someone on, they were talking about trauma and, is it dysfunction? Is that dysregulated? Mm-hmm. And for people who had never been regulated, like they came from a home where they weren't safe and they were always on guard and they, you know, they never had that good feeling. And then they try a drug or, you know, for some it's even cutting.
Yeah.
All of a sudden they feel this euphoria. Mm. Now, who's going to want to not have that when their life has been, you know, never safe, always on guard. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And it was like, but if they're not dysregulated, they don't have the euphoria. It's just when they are. Mm. And all of a sudden, I don't know. It was so interesting. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that is interesting. I can see where if you have sort of this, you know, gaping insecurity and all of a sudden there's some sort of chemical or some sort of behavior that gives you, you know, some sort of sense of control or completeness I would think if you grew up in a situation like that, just even a feeling of being secure and safe, whatever it may be.
I remember one person who grew up in a home that was never safe, I guess was very insecure. And all of a sudden he was omnipotent. You know what I mean? He was strong. He was fun with the kids. Like, he wasn't yelling. He was got addicted, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Rehab to get off. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. These medications will be used in addiction. There's studies being done in opioid addiction with these medications as well. But it does bring up, I think, a very fair question. And that is, what happens? What is the transfer addiction, or how do people process that? And I think it definitely, once we tread into the territory of these medications potentially being used in substance abuse disorders, it definitely raises the question about how do you ensure that those people get adequate care from a licensed professional that can walk them through that to make sure that they're not going from one addiction to a different one, or one vice to another vice. It will be all very interesting to see how that treatment unfolds, but the studies are being done, and there are stories that I hear every day, especially about the alcohol, people who are saying, you know, that they were drinking a significant amount of alcohol. Now, this never was my experience. I never was, and this may be the diabetic to non-diabetic experience that the studies show time and time again, that diabetics and non-diabetics respond very differently to these medications from a weight loss perspective, a side effect perspective, et cetera, et cetera. I never had that quieting of, you know, not wanting alcohol. I've had to regulate that on my own. And I do wonder if maybe at times, even because I was maybe less interested in food or wasn't getting from it what I once was, if I maybe leaned on that a little bit more. For me, I just cut it out completely, for mostly for health reasons, but,
the alcohol, you mean?
Yeah.
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 Wow. All right. We have to take our commercial break. I have a very important question that I want to ask. I wrote it down so I won't forget. And it's, can people get off these drugs? But don't answer now.
Okay.
Let's answer when we come back, and we'll be right back.
Awesome.
For a word from our sponsors.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Hey, it's Hillary from the Getting Real with Hillary Show. Life can be messy, raw, and real. And sometimes we're afraid to feel vulnerable. We're afraid to be that real self. Well, that's exactly what the Getting Real with Hillary Show and Getting Real movement is all about. Being our true selves. Every week, I bring you stories of transformation, authenticity, and hope. People getting real with their struggles, their faith, and their breakthroughs. So don't miss a thing. Subscribe to my weekly newsletter today. You'll get stories, links to everything new, and how to create a life you love every week directly to your inbox. You can also find my books on Amazon, my courageous and riveting memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, in case you feel stuck in your life and want to get inspired. How I came out about my no sex life and my marriage, and my second book, Real Talk. That one will get you speaking up in ways you've been too afraid to do so, and really creating amazing freedom. And my third book, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun, the name is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. Find links to everything and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Getting Real with Hillary, and you'll find the links in the header. So visit, and you can also visit gettingrealwithhillary.com, because the real you is worth it and wants to come out.
right. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors, Kikori. You can find them at kikoriapp.com. Jerry Dale, who has a phenomenal story of redemption. And if you're feeling like you're on the dark side, reach out to him at I Am Jerry Dale. We also have Ed Hajim, whose books are unbelievable. Born, grew up as an orphan, even though he had a father and a mother, and just achieved such success and overcame adversity. And then, of course, my books, you can find them all on Amazon.com. But I want to get Dave back. So welcome back, Dave. This is so fascinating. I mean, I know there's so many places you can go. And I know if people want to find you, they go to On the Pen. Where do they find your podcast?
Yeah. So the greatest, best gateway to all of our content, we're, of course, on all the social medias. Just search for On the Pen or Man on the Manjaro. But if you go to onthepen.com, that's the easiest way to just find everything that we're doing. I appreciate that.
So if you're someone struggling with obesity, diabetes, you know, looking at these drugs, Dave has done the work, and you can benefit from his work, right?
Yeah. Follow along. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
We cover a lot. I mean, you might wonder like how I have all this stuff in my head. We've read thousands of articles at this point, probably thousands of articles and videos on all of these topics. And so, it's all almost kind of like second nature for me to talk about it. That's why it's so easy to go off on a rabbit trail about any number of one of these topics.
Right. All right. Well, let's go back to you. You obviously you couldn't get the bariatric surgery. So you went on the one
Manjaro.
Of the drugs.
Yep.
On Manjaro. Okay. Man and Batura. And then did you start losing weight?
I did. Yeah, I did. And you know, so if you remember back to 3 years ago when we're, it feels like 3 years ago in this conversation where we were talking about, getting on the medicine and how I only lost 7 pounds after a year of keto. By that time, I was like, I'm done with the diets. I'm done with things that don't work. And so I just was like, I hope this medicine works because it feels like my only hope. I'm so fatigued of dieting. Mm. And that may sound defeatist, I don't know, to some people, but it's just honest. It's just how I felt at the time. And honestly, even almost 3 years later, it's kind of how I feel now too. So my journey with the weight loss.
When you said, you know, you were so fatigued and then you went on. You did the keto for a year and you were no longer diabetic, but you hadn't lost weight. Were you still so tired then?
I wasn't, the keto eating keto. That's kind of the double-edged sword is like, I do feel really good when I don't eat carbohydrates as a diabetic. If I want to feel good, I know I just don't eat carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the double-edged sword is now that I'm diabetic. It's very hard to eat carbs and feel good, right? Because you get these major swings in blood sugars that, and what I have learned about myself is I don't feel bad when my sugars are way up here. It's when they start to come down. So I don't know if it's the actual insulin production of the body or just that feeling of the crash of the sugars, but that's what kind of gets me in trouble in terms of how I feel. But when I started Manjaro, it was right at the height of the, they were pretty much giving it away when it first came out because people knew what Ozempic was and they knew if we're ever going to get it out there that we're better than Ozempic. And based on the clinical trials, it's quite a bit better than Ozempic for weight loss. They just started handing out these savings cards or these coupons that basically were from the manufacturer that allowed anybody who had a prescription to get it for $25. It's a $1,100 drug a month. And this was allowing people to get it for $25. So as you can
For the whole month,
$25. Yeah. And you didn't have to have diabetes diagnosis. A doctor could just prescribe it. You could get it for $25, which meant that it was very hard to find. And so if you follow the clinical trials, people lose weight all the way up and then they get to the highest dose of 15 milligrams. And that's sort of where they see the most weight loss. I had titrated up, like I skipped 2 or 3 of the doses because they weren't available, but I wasn't having side effects. So my doctor just moved me to the next higher one. And so I got to the highest dose, like a lot quicker than most people would have. And I leveled out on the weight loss pretty quick. So, I got down to at my lowest, which was about 5 or 6 months after I started Manjaro, I got down from that 312 to 277. And for the rest of the time, all the way up until today, I've just gone kind of up and down, up all the way, maybe back up to 295, then back down. Like, so right now, as I'm sitting here right now, I'm at 280. So I'm 32 pounds lighter than when I started Manjaro. And I'm about 40 pounds down, just under 40 pounds down from my highest weight when I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So about 12% of my body weight ish from my highest weight, which with Manjaro, type 2 diabetics, that's about average for what type 2 diabetics lose. It's right in there, the range. But for non-diabetics, I said that, you know, the drugs are experienced very differently between the two populations of patients. For non-diabetics, they'll usually get up to like 20 to 22, 23% weight loss. And so, of course, the outliers go much higher, 30%, 35%. So around 280 is what I weigh today.
And so you just stop losing, and then what happens? Do you stay on the drug?
Yeah, I stay on the drug because I'm diabetic.
You
know, so it's got my A1Cs normal, you know, so I don't have to be crazy with carbohydrate restriction to have my body behave normally. The medicine helps my body to behave normally. A lot of people think that these medications are insulin. I think we're sort of getting past that idea, but a lot of people thought these were just insulin. They're not. They actually, they are a hormone mimicking peptide that mimics your GLP-1 and GIP hormones, which stimulate your own pancreas to make your own insulin.
So you don't need insulin?
No, I've never taken insulin.
So your body makes it, and it's because of this drug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That mimics the peptide. Okay.
Yep.
Now, is it safe to stay on it? I guess if it's a
peptide,
right?
Yeah. I mean, so like I was saying earlier, it's a peptide wrapped in a fat molecule that mimics it. So structurally, if you think about it like a lock and key, the lock is on your cells. And that's the receptor, right?
Okay.
And then the hormone or the peptide comes around and it just locks together, right? So the hormone does this, but the peptide also does this. The difference is the natural occurring hormones dissolve or get broken down by that DPP-4 after 2 or 3 minutes, where these peptides, because they're wrapped in that fat molecule, will stick around for up to a week. And so they have a week-long half-life rather than minutes. And so they're orders of magnitude higher in their ability to bind to those receptors. And then you get all the cascading benefits like the satiation, like the slowing of digestion, like the secretion of insulin. So
there's no way to get rid of the DPP-4.
So there are DPP-4 inhibitors. I would love for more studies to be done about how to get the gut microbiome in shape, right? Because I think if we could actually get to the root cause of why are these gut bacteria so much higher in the guts of type 2 diabetics, then we could actually come to some more natural resolution. And it's interesting because the world of obesity medicine is like merging. So you have like a lot of people go, well, these medications are going to get rid of bariatric surgery. And actually what's happening is the science that they're learning from the medication is blending with the science that they know from surgery. And the two are kind of meeting in the middle. There's actually a company where I've interviewed the CEO a couple times. And what they're like, we want to get to the root cause. Why is there all this dysfunction? And one of the things that they've learned is that there's this little part of your body that lives between your stomach and your digestive tract. And it's called the duodenum. And the duodenum senses the nutrients as it passes through your stomach and into your intestines. There's cells on the surface of that duodenum that go, we've got fat, we've got sugar, we've got whatever. And it stimulates the release of some of these hormones. Well, what Fractal discovered, Fractal is the name of the company, Fractal Health. What they discovered is that if they go in and sort of do an ablation, almost like a face peel that, you know, people get, they can do that same kind of thing to the surface of your duodenum. And within a couple of days, all of the cells on the surface of your duodenum regenerate. And when they do that, all of a sudden, these gut hormones are restored. The endogenous gut hormones are restored. So they find that they can basically something in our diet is screwing with the cells of the duodenum, right? And it could be a number of things. I have my own theories. People hate it when I get into my theories because I'm not a medical doctor, but my personal theories would be alcohol can probably, you know, just think about alcohol and what it is in general. It could probably destroy those cells, right? Perhaps antibiotic use or certain chemicals that are put on our crops here in our country that aren't allowed anywhere else in the world. You know, I think this, I don't think it's one thing that there's one culprit, but there are a lot of things that are contributing to sort of this breakdown of the gut microbiome that are causing the disease of obesity to be exacerbated and presented in people who are genetically predisposed. And the same could be said for diabetes.
So I had a guy on, I don't know, I actually did his program, and he reverses type 2 diabetes. And he, I don't know, it would be so interesting for you to talk to him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know how, he didn't mention any of these drugs. And his program is, he doesn't take everyone. It's strict. I mean, I did it not for the diabetes, but because I have a lot of cancer in my family and dementia. And I was like, you know what, if I can clean myself up, you know, you get the tests and all that. And he does it in a different way. Diet. I mean, I cut out, let's see, caffeine, alcohol, sugar, all grains. Dairy.
It's a lot of restriction.
It was a lot of, it's a lot of, and right. And that's why not everybody can do it. But I only had to do it for 4 months, and then I got my coffee back, which I was excited. And you know, and I was not diabetic, so I didn't have all that, but he goes in and is like a detective. Sometimes it's a hormone imbalance, and sometimes it's, I forget. I can't remember the stories he told, but it would be interesting to tie any of that in with this duodenum?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I just think it would be interesting for you because you know more than me. I can't even answer the questions, but how was he doing? I can't remember some of the things, but he would see what was causing it. And a lot of times, you know, the doctors would just say, well, go lose weight and exercise. And he knew that wasn't going to work because of the underlying thing.
Dysfunction, right?
Yeah. And it wasn't always the same.
Yeah.
Person had something.
We're really bad. We're really good at, in this country, at treating the symptoms of disease and very bad at getting to the root cause of disease. And
yeah,
I mean, that's a whole nother tangent that I could get on because I've been very exposed to the medical community. I have lots of, you know, renowned medical doctors that are now friends of mine. But in a sense, many of them get locked into the ideas of these studies and these clinical trials, and everything gets wrapped in this word science. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure that the science is always serving the best interest of the general public. Oftentimes the science is actually serving industry. And so there are some, you know, I think there's a blending of these worlds, right? I mean, I can't imagine a world without many of the therapies that we have because of the science, right? My wife has rheumatoid arthritis. The only thing that's kept it at bay is a biologic. She's had it since 10 years old, but it's never had the opportunity to progress over her. She's almost 40 now. Wow. And it's never had the chance to progress and dominate her life. But if she didn't have these biologic drugs, that wouldn't be the case. So, you know, but also, you know, what are the root causes that feed that autoimmune disease? What are some of the things that can maybe trigger that in people who are genetically disposed? And that's where I think the world needs both. It needs those doctors that think outside of the box, and it needs those doctors that are, you know, just strict and can never think outside the box. And it needs those worlds to come together. And that is why I was really a big fan of what they were doing at Fractal, because I felt like it was a little bit more like outside the box. Like, what if people don't want to be on these shots forever? I think you asked, like, do you have to take these forever? And, you know, the clinical trial data shows that, yeah, I mean, if you're losing them for obesity, I'm not talking about your 10 or 15 pound cosmetic weight loss. I'm talking about for clinical obesity, you're going to have to be on them for life. And the data is bearing that out. And it, and rationality bears that out. If we really believe that it's a chronic disease, it's a relapsing disease. It's like blood pressure. You have high blood pressure. You don't go on a blood pressure medication and then get your blood pressure down and go, okay, I'm done taking the medication. What happens? Your blood pressure comes back up. You're getting on a statin to lower your cholesterol. You get your cholesterol good. You go off a statin, your cholesterol goes back up, right? Obesity is really no different because you're synthetically giving your body something that it doesn't do the right way. And so when you take that treatment away, of course, the positive benefits that of receiving that treatment also go away. And some people would vehemently disagree with that and say, but if you incorporate the right lifestyle changes, if you're doing the work along the way, you know, maybe, yeah, maybe, but I think by and large, if you zoom out and just look at how people treat obesity without the medication, you get a pretty good feel for what'll happen when they go off the medication. Anytime somebody goes on a crash diet or a super, super over the top workout regimen, it just, people don't tend to sustain that kind of radical behavior. It takes oftentimes time or money, both are which finite resources that people have or don't have, to be able to maintain that kind of lifestyle.
So, okay. So I was talking to this woman, and she went on she thought she was just going to die of obesity because she had given up. She went on a thing, you know, a program.
A thing like a shot or a...
Like a 12-step.
Oh, okay.
We won't name it because we can't even use her show because she mentioned the name. But she did it. And at age 70, she lost 150 pounds and she's kept it off for 6 years. It's very strict. She plans out her meals and, you know, could, let's say someone, you know, they have the DPP-4, you know, they got the food and oil, you know, all that stuff or all that other stuff. Could they go on? I mean, it's very strict. Look, it takes discipline and all that. Could they? Or is it like, no, they can't because of.
So you're saying if they got to, let's say, a goal or a maintenance weight with the medication, could they go off it and then go on some kind of program like that and maintain? Or,
well, or I'm saying,
or instead of the medication, just,
yeah, like, yeah, say instead, or
perhaps. But I think the deal is that this lady is probably the exception to the rule. She has a whole, it sounds like she has a whole livelihood built around this now.
She doesn't make money, but her life. It's a very strict, it's a whole program. It's just like, you know, I knew people with, I don't know what it was, overeaters anonymous, you know, they weigh the, I mean, they're very, very, very strict. Mm-hmm. Could someone, I mean, you know, I don't know if it's underlying mental stuff, emotional stuff, or would the physicality of the obesity because of these,
I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Could they? Or
I think it's a case by case basis. I think what you're trying to ask, if I understand correctly, is like how much of this is behavioral and how much of it is biological? Right.
Yeah.
How much of this could just be changed by behavioral changes, even if they're extreme, like they are in this lady's case? How much of that could be done with that, and how much of it is just biology, and your biology is going to fight against it no matter what you do. And I think it's a very different question for each individual person, and why getting good care from your doctor is so important. Because, you know, like I talked about earlier, the science bears out that type 2 diabetics, when they take the medicine, don't lose as much weight as people who are not diabetic. Right. And what that is, I think, indicative of is not that diabetic people are lazier than non-diabetic people and just don't do as well. I think there's metabolic dysfunction that's being addressed with the medication that's not having to be addressed in the people with obesity, right? There's the high insulin levels. There's the pancreatic dysfunction. There's a number of things, maybe even like a lot of times fatty liver and vitamin D deficiencies go hand in hand with type 2 diabetes. Depends.
I hate to interrupt this because it's so interesting, but we have a minute and a half to wrap up.
Oh, okay.
So
I told you it's easy to talk about this.
It is. And so find him on thepen.com. But what would you like to say in closing? What do you want to leave people with? I mean, obviously they can go to your site. They can listen to you. So much information.
Yeah. I think what I would leave people with is that There's going to be some people for sure in your audience who hear this and have a very strong opinion against what I say, but then, you know, I'm not going to change your mind. But to the person out there who's living in a larger body, who's done everything, who knows that your struggle isn't because you're lazy. It's not because you lack willpower. In fact, you may have a superhuman willpower because you've lived your whole life fighting against something that you've never been able to conquer. And you continue to fight even though you continue to quote unquote fail. There is hope out there. There are treatments. Science has evolved to treat this as the condition that it is. You're not alone and there's hope.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to share today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. I mean, obviously you have a propensity to understand all this, which I think helps. I don't know that I could, but obviously it's a passion for you and a purpose and the world needs you. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Hillary.
Thank you for being you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye, everyone. Don't forget onthepen.com. Very easy to spell.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.